Stories on voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. It's Thursday, July 9th. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in for the rest of the week for Yahias Wahib. Here's what's coming up on tonight's show.
We are now living in fear because the locals are saying that we are taking away their jobs. And when they want it in a violent manner. There is no room for negotiations. There is no room for talks.
That's Dason Mukwewa, a Zimbabwe truck driver in South Africa, where foreign drivers are facing a sometimes violent backlash from locals who want their work. And Uganda has deployed its military to stop a surge in cross-border cattle raids and looting by armed men from South Sudan. Plus, Malawi's new president appoints his cabinet. Those stories and more are next on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this evening, Ivory Coast's Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly died in Abidjan at the age of 61 on Wednesday. Coulibaly was a leading candidate for the country's presidency. Elections are scheduled for October in Ivory Coast. His sudden death came just days after he returned from 2 months of medical treatment in France, where he previously had undergone a heart transplant. Journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris has more.
The former prime minister has been known for having a recurring heart problems. But when he came back to Abidjan, he said he was fine, that he was ready to get back to work, and he was ready to be on the campaign trail for the next presidential election. What we know is what the government of Ivory Coast said. They claimed that he was in a cabinet meeting. He didn't feel well Wednesday. And after he was evacuated to a private hospital, that's where he died. Obviously, many people think that it's related to his heart issues. He received a transplant back in 2012, and it has always been difficult for him to deal with his political career and its health issues. But so far, we don't know officially the cause of death.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris. Ivorians reacted with shock to Coulibaly's death. Here's Julien Deloume Goto in Abidjan.
C'est un choc.
He says, it's a shock. It's a shock for Ivorians, but for Africa as well, who just lost a great man. Africa is crying. We are in mourning. Another Abidjan resident, Emmanuel Loba, agreed. He says, I have to say I was instantly very shocked. It hurt me because he was a great politician. He always chose his words. He always did politics without violence, and I really appreciated that about him. That's the type of politician that we want for this country, one that uses the right tone, that works discreetly. It was really a shock for me. The prime minister's death throws Ivory Coast's October presidential election into disarray. Coulibaly was the ruling party's candidate. Current President Alassane Ouattara is due to step down after 2 terms in office. Now the question is, who will replace Coulibaly as the ruling party candidate? For more, my VOA colleague James Butte spoke to Ngaga Lagoke. Lagoke is an assistant professor of history and Pan-Africana studies at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania and an Ivorian. Lagoke said President Ouattara handpicked the late prime minister because the president wanted to turn the ruling party over to the youth. Lagoke believes Coulibaly's unexpected demise could reignite the power struggle in the ruling coalition.
It is a catastrophe for the ruling party. We knew that Coulibaly was not feeling well. He had several heart failures, but for some reason, he was the choice of Mr. Ouattara, maybe the most loyal of all the people around him.
Lagoke says there are many possibilities for a new candidate.
The Minister of Defense, Ahmed Bakayoko, wants to run for president on behalf of Mr. Ouattara's party. And then Soro Guillaume, the former Speaker of the House, who decided, you know, to oppose Mr. Ouattara openly, now he's in exile because, you know, he was condemned by Ouattara justice system. And then the Speaker of the House does not feel well, and then he does not have the charisma and maybe the, you know, the passion to be the leader of Mr. Ouattara's party. There is a gentleman there called Patrick Ashi. He could become the prime minister of Mr. Ouattara, but he's from the south.
Lagoke says that a power struggle between southerners and northerners in the ruling party could determine who becomes the candidate.
If Patrick Ashi were to become the choice of Mr. Ouattara's coalition, it looks like a matter of last resort, because the northerners are anxious. They have the feeling that, you know, the power is like imploding. And then if they have to choose somebody from the south, they are not sure that that person, Patrick Ashi, is going to preserve the interest the way a northerner will do.
Another possibility is that Ouattara stays on for a third term. But is that legal?
He says that he can run based on the new constitution. But at the same time, those who put the constitution together in 2016 said that he could not run for president. So that's a huge debate.
That was Ngaka Lagoke, assistant professor of history and Pan-Africana studies at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. He spoke to my VOA colleague, James Butte. The United Nations says explosive devices planted in Libyan battle zones have left 138 dead since the end of May and that most of the victims are civilians. While fighting in Libya has quieted in the past month, analysts say massive buildups of weaponry on both sides from international supporters could portend the outbreak of a full-blown proxy war. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Istanbul.
In a video shared widely in early June, a man sits on the ground with blood on his face and one leg splayed lifeless to the side. "Where am I?" he asks in Libyan Arabic. The man holding the camera tells him he's on the airport road in Tripoli. His car hit an IED, improvised explosive device, and his companion was killed. On Sunday, another blast killed two humanitarian workers who were going house to house to remove explosive devices from civilian areas that not long ago were battle zones. This is 22-year-old Ahmed bin Mahmoud. His childhood friend, Tariq, was one of the victims. Witnesses told him Tariq and his colleagues were looking for bombs in the home of an elderly man. They found one and deactivated it. But another was hidden below, and two of the three men were killed when it exploded. 81 of the 138 victims were civilians, and many others were cleaning mines when they died. In February, the United Nations Mining Agency warned that Libya is awash with explosives, which pose a grave threat to civilians. This is Bob Seddon of the UN Mine Action Service in Libya.
Libya has the world's largest uncontrolled ammunition stockpile. It is estimated that there are between 150,000 and 200,000 tons of uncontrolled munitions across Libya.
The UN support mission in Libya says the bombs were planted by Libya's eastern forces, the Libyan National Army, which is loyal to strongman and de facto eastern leader Khalifa Haftar. Haftar's forces have been fighting those loyal to the Western government, the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, for more than a year since Haftar announced his intention to take Tripoli, the Western capital, by force. In early June, Haftar's forces withdrew from Tripoli, but both sides have since been supplied with massive amounts of weapons and air and ground support for other countries vying for power in Africa's most oil-rich country. Observers warn that while the fighting has been minimal recently, the stage is set for a protracted proxy war between powerful rivals like Turkey and Russia. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
Malawi's new president, Lazarus Chakwera, announced his 31-member cabinet last night, 10 days after he won the rerun of last year's overturned election. Chakwera was widely accused of using nepotism and political appeasement, which he had accused former president Peter Mutharika of practicing. The appointments include his party's vice president, Sidik Mia, party executive member Ken Kandodo, and broadcaster Gospel Kazako. He also appointed his wife, Abida, his sister, Kumbize, and his sister-in-law, Agnes. Journalist Lamek Messina talks with political analyst Vincent Kandowe about the new cabinet.
Ordinarily, this is quite a mixed bag, but largely very disappointing and a very patronizing cabinet that has been put in place to appease or patronize those who seem to have worked closely with the president. And largely, this is a cabinet which has not carefully addressed the thematic issues in terms of naming of the cabinet ministries.
Vincent, what you are saying is that the major problems that the president has appointed people he has been working with, what's the problem with that?
What is wrong is that when you look at the structure of government, it's supposed to be broad-based. It is supposed to be inclusive. And it's supposed to take on board different interests so that we build the nation as one whole and not necessarily satisfying the interests of the privileged few who are cronies of the president. By the end of the day, Lazarus Chakwera had campaigned against patronage, has campaigned against cronism, had campaigned against regionalism. But here we have a cabinet which has been squarely and largely appointed based on these very same systemic issues which the Tonse Alliance had campaigned against.
But what would be the problem in having the president appointing those people, appointing family members or relations he sees are competent to run government affairs in the ministries?
Competence in Malawi is not restricted to particular households. It is not possible for a brother and a sister coming from one family that are the only competent ones. So the argument is that based on this, it is not true that they have been appointed based on competence, because if it is competence, competence is not restricted to a particular family. So we're expecting the president to appoint people from a broad-based interest and not restricting himself to particular families that are connected to his political party, the Malawi Congress Party. And we have a crisis of the COVID-19. So our expectation was that the president would appoint a highly skilled, trained, tested, and experienced medical personnel who would come and do the job and not learning on the job. And here we have got a head of state appointing someone to head the Ministry of Health, and that particular person is not a trained or qualified medical person. And on top of that, from the same family, there are two cabinet members. So if it is a question of competence, we're expecting that at least with the crisis we have, the president would have appointed a minister of health who is a medical person.
But definitely, it's almost not possible to please everyone because we understand that in the past, such concerns were also there. So what do you think the new president could have done maybe to strike the balance?
It is not possible to please everyone, because there are a number of political interests, economic interests, and national interests which come into play when appointing the cabinet. So we're expecting a cabinet based on technocrats, one, two, broad-based coalition, three, a cabinet that would put national interests over and above narrow interests. But here, the cabinet has been largely appointed based on regionalism, because 20 members of the cabinet are coming from the central region. About 8 members of the cabinet are from particular families, and largely it's a cabinet of certain families connected to the president. So our expectation was that the president would appoint members of his cabinet based on national interest, based on their competencies and technical capabilities to drive the Tonse Alliance agenda.
So what action do you think the president should take right now, considering that he has already appointed the cabinet ministers?
It is not too late. These members of the cabinet have not been sworn in. So the president should take into account what the public is complaining about, because it seems there's a culture of democracy which is developing in Malawi, where people do not want political appointments to be tied to certain families. No.
Some would say these concerns are coming about just because people had too much expectations from the president.
We are not expecting too much. 26 years after democratization, we need to be talking about the policy-driven appointments that would drive the economic and developmental agenda of the state. The politics of appeasement, the politics of narrow interest, the politics of tribes, the politics of regions should be over by now. Whatever we are complaining against the DPP regime is exactly what the president has done. So it's a slap in the face. There's no question about it, but the president has to really listen to the voice of the people and reverse this mistake once and for all, because it is setting a very bad precedent and an agenda which we might be able to see for the next 5 years.
That was political analyst Vincent Kandoe speaking with reporter Lamek Messina. The United States has threatened to withdraw its security assistance from Burkina Faso after reports that the country's army carried out mass executions of 180 men. Yesterday, the New York-based Human Rights Watch organization issued a report accusing government forces of killing the men and burying them in mass graves in the northern town of Djibo between April and May. Tibor Naj, the top U.S. diplomat for Africa, says the report was, quote, very troubling and that, quote, U.S. security assistance cannot continue without action, end quote. Burkina Faso officials said the executions might have been committed by armed groups using stolen army uniforms and equipment. The U.S. has also condemned recent human rights abuses in Mali, which the U.N. peacekeeping mission there blames on government forces. The U.S. State Department said, quote, continued human rights violations and abuses risk undermining the state's credibility with its citizens, serve as a recruiting tool for terrorists, exacerbate the existing humanitarian crisis, and undermine efforts to bring security and stability to the region, end quote. Both Mali and Burkina Faso are battling jihadist militia in a spreading conflict that has killed over 1,000 people in recent years. All sides are accused of targeting civilians. Foreign truck drivers in South Africa say they are living in fear following a national strike by local drivers who are blockading roads, burning trucks, and demanding foreigners be fired. Some drivers have been assaulted and others forced to run for their lives. Journalist Tuso Kamalo reports from Johannesburg.
Driving cargo trucks has become a dangerous job for foreigners in South Africa. Local drivers want them out of the sector for good, saying they are taking work that should go to jobless citizens. It's an accusation that has extended to other labor sectors amid a national economic downturn and fostered deadly xenophobic attacks earlier this year on people who have come to South Africa from poorer countries in search of a better life. Dayson Mukwewa is a Zimbabwean national employed to deliver fresh farm produce across South African provinces. He says yesterday, a fellow Zimbabwean driver was attacked in Johannesburg and forced to flee before his truck was set ablaze.
We are now living in fear because the locals are saying that we are taking away their jobs, and when they want it in a violent manner. There is no room for negotiations, there is no room for talks. People are being injured, people are being attacked, regardless of the fact that we are documented and we are legal in this country.
Locals allege that 90% of the drivers in the trucking industry are foreign nationals. Manla Mgomezulu is the secretary of the All Truck Drivers Association. He insists that foreign drivers are not welcome, even if they are legal residents.
Only South African drivers must drive the trucks. We have drivers unemployed, but foreigners are driving the trucks. They are out with the trucks. That is our big problem.
During a national strike action Tuesday, some local truck drivers fired warning shots of what they may face if they don't park their trucks and leave the country. The government has condemned the attacks, insisting that foreigners who have proper documentation have a right to work in the trucking industry. Labor Minister Tulas Nxesi says his department is engaging the local drivers on their grievances.
We cannot just quarantine ourselves from the rest of the continent. We can't just do away with these foreigners. Some of them are refugees and legally they are supposed to be here. The issue we have to deal with is the illegal people who have been employed without any papers from Home Affairs.
Since 2018, several trucks have been towed and several foreign drivers killed in a bid by local drivers to force trucking companies to reserve all the jobs for South Africans. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. For more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. In Western Cameroon, hundreds of single mothers protested this week against the cultural practice of forced marriage. The women, who say their parents forced them into early marriages, urged authorities to help end the practice, saying it too often ends in broken families. Journalist Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
20-year-old single mother Metombem Aisha has been leading protests against the forced marriage of teenage girls in Western Cameroon. Around the towns of Fumbot and Fumban, parents often force their girls to marry early, believing that tying the knot after the age of 14 brings the family bad luck. Aisha says their protest at local palaces and in public urged Cameroonian authorities to put a stop to the cultural practice. Aisha says most of the 300 people protesting were 14 years old when they were forced to marry men they did not know. She says some single mothers among the protesters decided to leave their homes with their babies after their husbands brought home other wives. Parents should allow young girls to choose their husbands, says Aisha, to stop the pain that forced marriages are inflicting. Aisha formed the group Noon Sisters to support single mothers who leave these marriages and to push for an end to the tradition practiced among Cameroon's Muslims and in villages. The group says the girls should be allowed to go to school. The protest was sparked when a widowed 17-year-old mother was last week being forced to marry her dead husband's brother. The marriage was called off after the demonstrations. But local officials say they should protect cultural practices of their forefathers, including forced early marriage. Fumbot Palace official Usmanu Mifiru says early marriage ensures that girls are married with their dignity as virgins. According to cultural norms, if a girl is a virgin, the groom's family gives her family more gifts as a so-called bride prize. Her parents are also praised as modern members of the community. Mefiru says that tradition holds firm that a girl has no say on whom her husband should be. He says when a girl is 14, her father contacts the parents of a potential husband and they discuss the possibility and date for the marriage. Tradition also holds that a man who sees a girl he wants to marry should inform his parents, says Mifiru, not the girl. But Cameroon's district-level officials say they oppose forced early marriage. Fumban district official Julian Gael Konu says the government is bent on eradicating such harmful traditions. He says forced marriages are rampant all over Cameroon, but more concerning in the west of the country. He says in these mainly Muslim communities, there are misconceptions that boys should make their choices while girls stay at home to prepare for early marriage. Since they are finding it difficult to convince people that boys and girls should be treated equally, says Kono, they will start punishing those who abuse their rights. Cameroonian authorities say 6 out of 10 girls in these communities are forced to marry before the age of 16. Last year, Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics, citing the UN, said nearly 1/3 of girls were married before their 18th birthday. But in 8 out of 10 of the forced marriages, the wives end up leaving their husbands before turning 18. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News. Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and our entire team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening and for choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports.